Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Illinois voters will decide whether to change from a flat to a graduated income tax where the wealthier pay a higher rate. Public policy journalist Dan Vock has looked at the implications if the tax proposal passes and the ones if it does not. Vock speaks with Sean Crawford about his article in Illinois Issues. Vock starts by defining the fiscal predicament that faces the state.
Illinois has the worst credit rating of any state in the country, and that reflects a lot of different financial problems that Illinois has. So Illinois has a backlog of somewhere between $7 and $8 billion in unpaid bills. It has a massive pension liability. And on top of that, now you have the coronavirus, which is cutting the revenue that's coming to the state. So all the states are being negatively affected by the coronavirus and the recession that's resulted. But Illinois has fewer options because it's been trying to deal with all of its other budget problems coming into the crisis.
So there's a lot of need there for money. The idea to impose a higher rate on income above $250,000, that would bring in a windfall to the state. How would that money be used?
Well, the governor says that he wants to use that to address what's been a chronic problem in Illinois budgets, which is that, you know, when you add up all the revenue coming in and all the expenses that are supposed to be taken care of, it seems that every year they're just a little bit short, and that little bit is actually a lot, but it's $2 to $3 billion. So the idea when the governor proposed this was that this would bring in somewhere around $3 billion a year, and that would take care of that sort of chronic, what they call structural deficit. So that's what this money would be used for on the governor's plans. Obviously, there's a lot of, as we mentioned, other stresses going on, but that's sort of the idea of why the governor was pushing this.
Supporters, including the governor, have framed this as an either-or scenario. Either it's approved or some difficult choices would have to be made. What would those most likely involve?
The governor hasn't listed all the things he would want to do if his amendment fails. Obviously, his hope is that the amendment passes and that more money would come in. However, it's pretty likely that there would be some borrowing involved. The legislature authorized the governor to borrow money from the Federal Reserve under a special program for coronavirus relief. And Illinois has already done that once, but they could do it again. Another option that's probably going to be discussed, if not actually enacted, would be a broad-based income tax hike. So right now, most people pay about 5%, and it would, could go up to, say, 6%. So something along those lines. Those are sort of the big things that could get through. And then the third possibility is that Congress could come and help with the coronavirus-related sort of expense fall-off. But that still leaves, the year-over-year problems that Illinois has. So that's only going to help through this economic crisis.
Now, I know opponents to this graduated tax proposal, including Republicans, are saying, well, there's another alternative, and that would be to take a closer look at our spending, make some cuts, make some changes in policy in the state. That doesn't seem as likely with Democrats in total control, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see some sort of reductions. The question is, how much? So the governor has asked his agency directors to come up with some potential cuts for this year and for the coming year, 5% for this year and 10% for the next year. But we should know that the governor also did something similar last year. He also asked his agency directors to come up with potential cuts. The question is, how much are they willing to put those cuts out there? The governor argues that this is not the time to cut down on, say, the public safety spending for state police or the National Guard. It's not the time to reduce spending for schools that are already under stress because of all the coronavirus sort of extra expenses and kids not showing up. And so he's saying basically this is a time when people need the social services. They need the services provided by the state. So I think it's going to be hard for them to make any deep cuts, although you'll probably see some cuts being enacted.
While we're on the subject of the opponents to this, we're also seeing quite a bit of advertising that's going on out there right now, saying this could lead to raising taxes on small businesses, could lead to raising taxes on retirement income, which right now the state does not tax. We're hearing a lot of different arguments here. Do they hold water from what you've been able to find?
Well, I think it's one thing to keep in mind is that if this fails, the legislature could also tax retirement. The reason Illinois doesn't tax retirement income right now is a political choice. It has nothing to do with the powers of the legislature. So that would not change one way or the other. You know, the governor says he's against retirement income. He told me that, you know, he doesn't support it. The Democrats won't support it. The treasurer's also floated the idea of taxing retirement income. But that, I think, was in a forum over the summer. But now he says that he's completely against that idea. So it is possible that they could tax retirement income if the fair tax passes, but it's also possible they could tax retirement income if it doesn't pass. So there's a lot of speculation as to what will happen if this tax passes or if it doesn't. The amendment itself doesn't help or hurt the chances of retirement income tax getting passed.
Governor Pritzker, since he took over, has been relying on this idea of a graduated tax. And I know some have felt that he's kept the budget in a holding pattern, just waiting for this to occur. And I guess we'll find out soon if that strategy worked or not. But, Dan, it seems like it's been a gamble for Pritzker.
Especially in this last year, the governor and the legislature have tried to keep their options open. And one big reason for that is the effect of the coronavirus pandemic. So a lot of states have tried to hedge their bets a little bit to try to see, you know, how the economy is going to respond. Will the coronavirus go away quickly? Will stores start, you know, reopening? Will people start spending money again? That was one factor that people, especially legislators, didn't know this spring when they were crafting budgets. Another factor is what Washington is going to do. Will they come to the aid of not only state governments specifically, but also local governments, transit agencies, universities, and everybody that sort of depends on state government support? So there has been a lot of sort of hedging on, but I don't think it's all because of the fair tax vote. I think that's a big part of it. Obviously, the governor's not going to want to go cut popular programs if it turns out that the state does have money to fund it. On the other hand, with the coronavirus, there's a lot of uncertainty. And so I think that they are sort of trying to keep their options open for as long as they can. One example would be the borrowing from the Fed, which they have until December to decide whether they're going to do. I don't think they're going to hear a decision about that until you know how the fair tax fares and how much money Illinois is going to have available to it.
Well, you're on that subject. What are the pros and the cons of that? I mean, bringing in some money and helping pay down bills certainly makes some sense, but there's probably some other long-term cons to the idea as well.
Right. And, you know, Illinois is already highly leveraged as a state goes. Moody's pointed out recently that only Connecticut has sort of a higher rate of debt to revenue. So Illinois has a low credit rating, which means that when it borrows money, it has to pay a higher interest rate. So like if you have a low credit score, your interest rates on your credit cards are going to be higher. So the idea that Illinois could go to the Federal Reserve and get a low-interest loan is attractive to sort of bridge the gap. The problem is that it's a short-term loan, that these are due within 3 years. If you take out, say, $5 billion, you're going to have to find another $1.5 to $2 billion for each of the next 3 years to pay that money back. So it helps you in the short term, but in the not-too-long term, it really makes balancing the budget even more difficult.
That's public policy journalist Dan Vock, who spoke with Sean Crawford. Read Vock's report online at Illinois Issues. This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hunters use lead shot to cull the deer population, often with shotguns that use really small pellets. Lead is poisonous. Does lead make it into venison harvested and sold in central Illinois? A new study done by two Illinois Wesleyan University professors shows yes, it does, and that's bad. Given Harper and Aaron Schultz-Wilson say the odds are pretty good there's lead in that venison.
So we found in 27 firearm harvested ground venison packets from 10 different deer, we found lead fragments in actually 48% of the packets.
Also, the size of the fragments is actually fairly small. I think that that's why they don't get noticed during the processing of the deer and don't get removed. Any exposure to lead is bad. There's no, as far as we know, there is no bottom limit where you can say, well, if you eat this much lead, you're okay. It just, and the more we study it, the further down that bottom kind of goes, that bottom threshold.
How fast does lead leach into a person's system? So if, for instance, if one were to have a meal of deer or venison with lead shot into it, is that going to stay in the body longer and be absorbed more than, say, chips of lead paint among children, which is the more commonly known problem for lead?
The fragments are not going to be taken up, this whole amount of lead in a like a little fragment of lead shot. It's not going to be taken up by the body very efficiently. And in fact, adults only take up about 15%, somewhere in there, of the lead that they ingest. On the other hand, children who are exposed to lead, children's body are better at assimilating that lead, and they're going to take up about 50% or half the lead that they ingest. Once it's in your system, it can stay for a long time. It can get into your bones.
What made you want to tackle this problem? What made you want to look at it, Given?
Actually, I am a deer hunter. I had read papers about lead contamination in venison, but that was with hunters using rifles. And of course, in Illinois, hunters use mostly shotguns, some muzzleloaders. So I was curious, and so I decided to get some venison packets from different hunters. To what extent that lead contamination was in the ground venison from shotgun slugs.
48% seems like a lot. It would seem like a hazard that might have been noticed earlier.
Yeah, again, most of the studies, though, had been done with rifle bullets, and those bullets travel at a faster rate of speed and tend to fragment more than shotgun slugs.
What do most hunters hunt with?
So in Illinois, it's about 90% of the deer that have been killed over the past several years have been harvested with shotguns.
So is there likely a need to require a change in the production of ammunition? And how would that play out in the legislature at war among hunters? It sounds like it might be more expensive to have steel slugs.
You know, there's non-toxic, non-lead ammunition available. And based on the results of our study, certainly we would encourage hunters to try to use those non-toxic ammunition.
Are there comparable studies in other states that replicate this result?
We started looking at some of those other studies. So there have been studies in Canada, and there have been studies in Europe, are primarily where we were able to get numbers, so amount of lead or concentration of lead. Whereas studies from the United States, there have been some great studies looking at the presence of fragments, but not as many studies saying, okay, once we found a fragment, this is how much lead was actually in the meat.
Is it likely that there needs to be regulation? I mean, lead is cheaper and lead is traditional. Is that something we just need to move away from?
I know the state of California has enacted a lead ammunition ban. And one of the major problems encountered there was that the endangered California condors, that was their major mortality issue, is that they were feeding on carcasses the animals had been killed with lead ammunition, and they were dying of lead poisoning.
What are you going to do with this study? What's next?
We hope that it will increase awareness, especially among hunters, because the concern about their health and the health of their families. But I think also there's another issue as well, is that there has been a statewide program of hunters donating deer to food pantries. You know, there may be a concern there too. I also want to point out, certainly we're not arguing against hunting. For years, I used lead ammunition, but once I discovered this, I've switched to non-toxic ammunition. So hunting is vital in controlling the deer population.
The paper in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology is Lead Contamination in Ground Venison from Shotgun-Harvested White-Tailed Deer in Illinois. The lead authors are Illinois Wesleyan University's Aaron Schultz-Wilson and Given Harper, along with Genevieve Alexander, Minori Perara, and veterinarian Matt Fraker of Bloomington Normal.
The paper also notes that meat processors tend to mix meat from multiple deer when they grind venison. The grinding may also further fragment the lead shot. Deer season begins November 14th in Illinois. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The pandemic is a drag. There's no way around it. One good fix: a fuzzy, clumsy, cuddly puppy. Pet adoptions skyrocketed during the stay-at-home order in March. As Dana Vollmer reports, the run on quarantine companions does not seem to be letting up.
For those who long dreamed of welcoming a pet into their life, the pandemic presented an opportunity. Lots of free time spent at home. That's what finally made Amanda Bales crack. She'd been waiting until she was more settled. She used to move a lot for work and didn't think it would be the right time to get a dog until she had a house with a yard and a doggy door. Then COVID happened. The English lecturer found herself working remotely.
That was definitely at a point where I was still completely, you know, like isolation, like I wasn't even going to the store, et cetera. And I was basically like, if I don't have some sort of like mammalian contact, I'm going to lose my mind.
She had a vision for what she wanted in a dog: older, female, beagle-sized, and pretty lazy. Then she saw Axton.
Male and a puppy. He was 10 weeks old. And, you know, like a variety of breeds, but there's definitely some pointer in there. So like definitely be exercised for a couple hours a day. The opposite of all the things that in my head, but it's absolutely true. I mean, like the minute, you know, I got him and got him home, we have, you know, he's been my best bud and it's been great.
Bales says this year is hard with politics and environmental catastrophes, let alone the pandemic.
With all of these things going on at the same time, like a creature who just has no idea that any of that is happening and is just like wakes up every morning joyful, it makes a massive difference. Everything else kind of seems tinged a little bit, except for him and like the way he's experiencing the world.
She's not the only one finding comfort in a quarantine pet. Stephanie Bureau works with Pet Central Helps, the organization that found Axton a home. Pet Central started in 2017. It's an entirely foster-based organization until they build a shelter for homeless pets. Bureau says so far this year, Pet Central has placed more than 650 dogs and cats, the vast majority after the pandemic began. It's a significant increase over the previous year. Bureau herself has had a fair number of animals pass through her home.
We have fostered 49 animals. We have our 49th currently in our house, and during quarantine alone, we have fostered 9.
Bureau says the foster-based model helps find better fits for forever homes. Foster parents get to know the animals' quirks and personalities, but it doesn't always work out. Owners have returned about 60 fur babies to Pet Central this year, either because they didn't get along with other family members or pets, or because the owners didn't anticipate the responsibility.
Even if you are home all the time to train them, it's still a lot of work to do it, and it does take a lot of patience. My brother adopted a puppy and he's kept him, but he definitely went through a phase in potty training where he thought he might lose it.
The Central Illinois Humane Society has seen a similar trend. Manager Jane Common says at the beginning of the pandemic, it was hard to even get animals into the shelter for adoption.
What I have noticed is that the people that ran out and bought dogs, I'm seeing some of those dogs and puppies come into the shelter now because people realize, oh, I'm back to work. I just don't have the time.
still come and says adoptions are going strong. She says the longest they've had an animal at the shelter is about 2 months. In normal times, some would be there nearly a year before they found a home. Now Common says animals leave just as soon as they come in, even the more exotic animals.
Right now, we actually have a potbelly pig. His name is Taz, and he is just a love. And we already have somebody coming to look at him.
Common says there are some questions people need to ask themselves before getting a quarantine companion.
Are you looking at the whole family dynamic? Will, you know, the animal just slide right in there as your companion? Or is it just going to be a lawn decoration, more or less, to say, oh, I rescued a dog during the pandemic?
Common says she was originally worried that as the state gradually reopens and people return to relative normalcy, the shelter might get flooded with animals once again. So far, that hasn't been the case. I'm Dina Vollmer.
For more adoption stories and to see Bloomington Normal's quarantine companions, go to WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker.